Welcome to Christianity Saga. This is Chapter 1, Setting the Scene. It is the year 783. Ab urbe conditia, that is, 783 years since the founding of the city of Roma, for that's all that really mattered at the time. Or perhaps one could date it as the 16th year since Tiberius had been appointed princeps of the res publica, meaning the first citizen of the Roman Republic, by the Roman Senate. History has since pried back the wax and torn down this humble facade, calling Tiberius what he really was, the second emperor of the Roman Empire. History would also call it 30 AD, the abbreviation for Anno Domini, meaning the 30th year of the Lord, or, in an increasingly secular context, year 30 of the Common Era. The great Kaiser Augustus, the adopted son and heir of Julius Caesar, had passed, and Augustus's wife, Livia, had only died the previous year, and both received divine honors, though Livia's would not be confirmed for another decade. They had established, for the first time in its remembered history, peace and stability for the territory under Roman rule. The new princeps, Tiberius, was Augustus's adopted son, maintaining his predecessor's policy of no military expansion, only having to extend the might of the Roman military a few times to punish some Germanic tribes along the Rhine, handle a revolt in Gaul, and suppress a guerrilla war in North Africa, and for a territory which spanned all around the Mediterranean. It is perhaps more than can be said for the entire subsequent history of the region. Rather than invoking the Roman military to address stability issues in Armenia, Tiberius supported a diplomatic end to hostilities. Plinius the Younger, following the propaganda machine of Augustus and Tiberius, dubbed this period of peace Pax Romana, 25 years later. One should not limit the impact of Pax Romana on the relationship between Rome and its neighbors, since it applied equally, if not more so, to internal conflict. Internecine civil war, interspersed with purges of the elite, had gripped the last century and a half of the Roman Republic. Augustus had prevailed over his enemies, and then had survived long enough to establish a new world order. One is perhaps reminded of the rather long reign of England's Queen Elizabeth, who, in many ways just by not dying, rescued England from turmoil and established its future direction as a nation. For Rome, Pax Romana is all the more impressive when one reflects on the massive swaths of territory under Rome's control, from the Atlantic coasts of Spain and France, around the Mediterranean and most of the Black Sea coasts, and this at a time when it took over 60 days to travel from Roma to Aqepta, the province of Aegyptus, modern-day Egypt, moving along the specially designed, for official government use only, trail of fresh horses called the Cursus Publicus, at the incredible pace of 50 miles per day over land. This is the amount of time it currently takes a modern ship to circumnavigate the globe, and to imagine that that was the quickest way one could communicate with such an important province as Aegyptus. One wonders how an empire could be maintained over such great distances. Not to mention that the reply would take equally as long, and the indomitable Roman military could certainly not move at that pace for that long. At the same time, Tiberius relied heavily on his local provincial administrators to run the various provinces, providing tax revenues to support Rome, and imposing the Roman legal system on their province to maintain peace and order. If there was a revolt, the Roman army, funded by the collected tax revenues, would restore the province. And, for the most part, Tiberius had good provincial governors, and he wisely left them in place. Two of the most important provinces for Rome were Aegyptus and Africa, modern-day Tunisia and western Libya, by far the wealthiest and also the suppliers of grain to the great city of Roma, a city which had long since been unable to support its own population. Other provinces proved less significant, except insofar as they provided continuity within the empire and provided a buffer against hostile powers. One such backwater that proved a rather challenging province to govern was Judea, and it was at this time that the prefect maintained his obligation to keep peace and order by executing one potentially rebellious individual by crucifixion, Rome's favorite device, which served the dual purpose of both eliminating a clear threat through the slow, shameful, and agonizing death on a cross, while making a public display to ward off other potential rebels. The province of Judea sat in much the same location of modern-day Israel, in the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean. It formed a small rectangle, with its southern border drawing a line between the southern tip of the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean coast. Another line, heading north along the Jordan River from the Dead Sea to the southern shores of the Sea of Galilee. And the northern edge forms a line from the bottom of the Sea of Galilee to the Mediterranean coast. From south to north, the regions were Idumea, Judea, and Samaria. The land to the immediate north, Galil or Galilee, and the east, Perea, were ruled by Herodes Antipatros as a client state of the Roman Empire. The land was not particularly fertile, nor was it docile. The regional climate provided little more than subsistence living to the scattered villages in the foothills, and experienced failed harvests over a quarter of the time. Politically, the region had achieved independence from the Seleucid domains, a powerful splinter empire of Alexander the Great's short-lived conquest. Internal division and factionalism around the mid-first century BC eventually precipitated a requested Roman intervention in 63 BC, when Judea became a tributary state of Rome. Subsequent intrigues sought Roman political support, and Antipatros of Idumea eventually prevailed, having his son, Herodes the Great, given the title King of the Jews by the Roman Senate in 40 BC. After mismanagement by several of Herodes' successors, Rome stepped in and incorporated Idumea, Judea, and Samaria into the Roman province of Judea in 6 CE. As mentioned before, Herodes Antipatros was considered a capable ruler and permitted continued control of Galil and Perea. His focus on massive building projects, including whole cities like Tiberias, and his penchant for naming these projects after key Roman figures, perhaps bought him sufficient good graces until he eventually provoked war with the neighboring Nabataeans, lost much of Perea, and was exiled with the then princeps, Emperor Caligula, in 44 CE. The proconsul of Syria, during the incorporation of the Judean client state into the Roman Empire, Quirinius, was tasked with taking a census of the population to determine taxation details. While there was initial compliance, Josephus, Yosef ben Matityahu in Hebrew, notes that this census spurred the creation, or at least expansion, of a revolutionary guerrilla movement led by Yehuda and Zadok, extremists called Zealots, who campaigned against paying taxes to any foreign power, since God, Yahweh, instead was the only ruler. Their campaign used assassination and guerrilla attacks to accomplish its ends, and we'll meet them again a little later. The challenge of governing such a financially worthless piece of property begs the question why Rome would have an interest in the region at all. The answer seems to lie in it being the primary coastal and land route to the wealth of grain coming out of Aegyptus. Judea provided a position to prevent the Nabataeans to the south and east from interfering with grain shipments. At this time, the prefect of the region was Pontius Pilatus, remembered by history as Pontius Pilate. His base of operations was in the port city of Caesarea, in the northwest corner of Judea. The contemporary Jewish writer Pilon, as well as Josephus, writing a generation later, both record that Pilatus had a habit of antagonizing the Jewish population. Pilon referred to him as very obstinate, very merciless, and of a very inflexible disposition. For example, early in his governorship, Pilatus had his soldiers bring ensigns of Caesar into Jerusalem under cover of night. Any images or related symbols in the Jewish holy city were forbidden by Jewish law, called Torah, and customs, so this act resulted in social unrest as the inhabitants gathered to protest the sacrilege. After calling up his soldiers, Pilatus eventually withdrew the ensigns, as he became aware that the Jewish people appeared quite willing to die rather than let the sacrilege stand. Throughout his tenure, Pilatus was at odds with the leaders in Judea, and seemed to have taken actions just to annoy them. Pilatus' behavior stands in contrast to the behavior of his predecessors, who had attempted, more or less, to keep the peace by not transgressing local customs. The Jewish people's responses to Pilatus' transgressions followed the same general principle of the revolt against the Seleucid ruler Antiochus IV, who had established an altar in the midst of the sacrosanct Jewish temple. This event sparked a revolt led by the Maccabee family in the 160s BC against Antiochus and foreign, namely Hellenistic, influences, eventually achieving Jewish independence. It is a mistake, however, to try to separate the political and religious inspirations for these events. Like most communities in the ancient world, these two aspects were inextricably linked, and the concept of secular was alien. This outlook is not so different from societies today, in which political and non-political ideologies, from Christianity, Buddhism, and Islam, two popular secular ideologies, remain tightly coupled. Political actions are deemed morally wrong by their opponents when a difference of opinion is all that is involved, and many consider their selected candidates ordained by God or naturally better, while the opposition leader is characterized as an embodiment of evil. The Jews believe themselves to be the chosen people of their God, known as Yahweh, albeit by this period, his name was usually considered too holy to be profaned by speaking it, and substitutes like Adonai and Hashemah were regularly used. According to their scriptures, Yahweh had promised them the land of Canaan, identified with modern-day Israel-Palestine, as their inheritance. This region, along the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, would be ruled by an eternal kingship starting with King David, who likely ruled around 900 BC, on condition that they be obedient to his law called Torah. The God-given Torah code was what Antiochus IV, Pilatus, and Quirinius had transgressed, and the zeal and obedience of the people alone would rectify the transgression and end the oppression. To further complicate matters, many, perhaps most Jews, were adhering to Torah with increasing infrequency, as they instead espoused Hellenizing influences, that is, adopting Greek language, philosophy and religion, education, and culture, which incorporated the previously foreign lifestyle of gymnasia, theater, art, and architecture. Hellenization also adapted traditional methods of interpreting the Tanakh, the Jewish scriptures, to align them with Greek philosophy using methods like allegory to accomplish this task. Perhaps the most notable proponent of this method was Philon, whom we met earlier when discussing Pontius Pilatus' relationship with his Jewish subjects. For more traditionally minded Jews, this was a betrayal, not just of their culture and heritage, but these Hellenized Jews were traitors to the God of the universe himself. The last time this had happened, their independent Jewish state, established by King David, had fallen to the invading Assyrians and Babylonians. And this betrayal may very well have been the cause of their occupation by the Roman invaders, or so many believed. The Jewish communities were divided on how to respond. Many accepted or even embraced the Hellenized world, becoming entirely unrecognizable as Jews. Apart from their religious observance, Jews looked like just about everyone else in the Eastern Mediterranean. While others adopted a Hellenized, non-traditional understanding of their Jewish practice, while still others worked to establish traditional Jewish communities, regardless of where they settled throughout the Roman Empire. In fact, practicing Jews were already spread throughout the Roman and Arshakid empires, through the Arabian Peninsula and even further afield. The Roman Empire, at least, permitted Jews to practice their religion regardless of where they lived within the empire, and did not compel participation in Roman religious festivals, many of which were considered equally patriotic and religious events by loyal Romans, as, again, politics and religion are closely linked. Thus, it is understandable that the Romans saw the Jewish avoidance of Roman celebrations as anti-Roman sentiment, like prisoners of war, and so the Roman political machine's attitude toward Jews would shift unfavorably, as it would toward many Eastern cults, including Christianity. It would be impossible to explicate the continuum of different beliefs of the Jewish people, even if we restrict ourselves to Judea. Not only do we lack the material, but we are also missing the Jewish perspectives of the spectrum of beliefs in the few sources we do possess. For example, the Jewish historian Josephus provides a superficial view of four primary groups: Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and the fourth, philosophy, but presents them to a Hellenized audience according to the standards of Hellenistic understanding. Nevertheless, historians have been able to piece together the details with other manuscript and archaeological evidence to at least provide a helpful framework for approaching the breadth of first century Jewish practice. First, a group called the Sadducees, Tzedukim, stepped into the role of ritual leaders around maintenance of the Jerusalem temple, as specified by Torah. The maintenance was the vocation of priests, who were not necessarily Sadducees, though many were. The Sadducees also directed many political matters on behalf of the Romans, accepting their political domination by collecting taxes, keeping the peace, equipping and leading the military, and serving as mediators on behalf of the Jewish people. As such, they tended to be from the aristocracy. They also participated in governance through the Sanhedrin, a judicial body, and while still conservative, tended to favor Hellenizing influences in collaboration with non-Jewish leaders. For this reason, during the Jewish Revolution in 66, the Sadducee elite were among the first to be killed. A second group, the Pharisees, Parashia, also participated in the Sanhedrin, though they adopted a rather different outlook. While they were similarly tolerant toward Roman occupation, some tended to a more revolutionary stance alongside the fourth philosophy, whom we will visit with shortly. They interpreted Torah, the written law, alongside an oral law, which also required obedience. It further decentralized the importance of the temple practice, the center for the Sadducees, especially since the current temple had been extensively renovated by a non-Jew, Antipatros of Idumea, the king of the Jews we met earlier. It was thereby seen as ritually impure. The Pharisees transferred the purity laws associated with the temple and priests to ordinary Jews, and endeavored to hold all Jews to high standards of morality and ritual purity. Widely regarded as the foremost interpreters of Jewish law, Torah, the Pharisees tended to be the most beloved by the Jewish populace, according to Josephus, who was quite possibly one of their number. This popular appeal stood in contrast to the elite and aristocratic Sadducees, but also in contrast to the revolutionary fighters, the fourth philosophy. The perspective espoused by this fourth philosophy, manifesting at different points as Sicarii and Zealots, seemed primarily interested in promoting violent revolution against the Roman authorities as the only means of establishing Jewish freedom, relying on assassination and other means against anyone who even appeared to be collaborating with the Roman authorities, including, on several occasions, the murder of prominent Sadducees. They seem to have accepted many of the predominant beliefs of the Pharisees, but had refused to compromise on matters like paying taxes to a foreign government, and then taken the implementation to violent extremes. The coming God-ruled Jewish kingdom required human effort, and needed it now. Josephus cites them as the instigators of the later Jewish revolts. Another radical position can be found in the Essene community, possibly the writers of Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls, recovered in the late 1940s. Rather than pursuing violence, the Essenes sought to create ritually pure communities dedicated to peace, asceticism, voluntary poverty, and mysticism, thereby agreeing with the Pharisaic view that the temple was impure, but extending that impurity to the Jewish community at large. They, therefore, neither participated in Jewish ritual life, nor paid visits to the impure, foreign-constructed temple in Jerusalem, focusing on their own internal purity. In so doing, the Essenes shared the anticipation with the fourth philosophy and Pharisees that Yahweh would soon overcome the Roman invaders and establish peace under the rule of a new King David, a king of the line of David, who would establish an independent kingdom of Israel and would rebuild the temple so that Torah could be properly observed. The future liberator, or liberators, as some thought, perhaps a king and a priest, was called the Mashiach, meaning anointed, as in the one who was anointed as king. There was a diversity of beliefs about the coming Mashiach, and with our limited source material, it can be challenging to identify a fully fleshed out framework. There seem to have been three notions in particular. The first, as mentioned previously, related the Mashiach to a real human being who would reign as king of Israel, quite possibly king of the entire world. He would accomplish this through military means, an uprising similar to that of the Maccabean uprising against the Seleucid ruler Antiochus 200 years earlier. A second view saw less a Mashiach and more of an apocalyptic messianic age in which Yahweh himself would be present on the earth in his temple and usher in an era of peace and prosperity. What exactly this was expected to look like is difficult to nail down in detail, as is frequently the case with apocalyptic literature. But it would bring peace and justice to all. A third view invested a future priest with the attributes of the Mashiach rather than a king. This view was particularly popular among priests, as one might imagine. The concept of Mashiach is critical to understanding the inception of Christianity, as Christians saw the criminal, whom the prefect Pontius Pilatus ordered to be executed, as the Mashiach. The man's name was Yeshua, Jesus in Greek, and oddly pronounced Jesus in English. And around the year 783, Ab Urbe Conditia, or 30 AD, or 30 CE, his followers declared that he was the Mashiach, even though he had been executed. The new Jewish kingdom had come, and this hinterland, conquered by the Roman Empire, would become the conqueror of Rome itself. In so doing, however, it would lose much of its Jewish character, suffer persecution from fellow Jews and Romans alike, and be confronted with making sense of what it meant that the Mashiach had come. But the Roman Empire remained as powerful as ever.